And it is today's Topical Currents. Joseph Cooper with you, along with Bonnie Berman. And today we discuss the plight of the legal profession with veteran trial attorney and professor Stephen Harper. He makes a case against large law firms and law schools in his book, The Lawyer Bubble, A Profession in Crisis. He criticizes legal education as well as the bottom line mentality of the big law firms. And he joins us from Wilmette, Illinois. Welcome to you, Stephen Harper.
Thanks very much. Thanks for having me on.
Hi, Professor.
You
say that what's happened in the legal profession in the past 25 years is a slice of what's wrong throughout American culture. What do you mean by that?
Well, we've developed an obsession with two things. One, measuring things, and two, maximizing short-term results. So we've become myopic in our focus on the illusory comfort, what I call the illusory comfort of a numerical solution, particularly if we can relate it to some sort of short-term consequence. So, for example, in law schools, the short-term consequence for many deans, the only consequence that matters is the U.S. news ranking. For big law firms, the only short-term consequence that matters is this year's average partner profits. And you can find the similar threads, you know, throughout our society. It's a fixation that we have, and it's the combination, as I say, of the search for the illusory comfort of a numerical solution combined with a myopic short-termism that ignores longer-term values that are, frankly, can be far more important to the survival of institutions and the well-being of the people in them.
Stephen Harper, you teach law at Northwestern, but you're also, I have to hand it to you, you're quite critical of that institution and its law school. What are your complaints with Northwestern? And are they typical of others?
Yeah, I mean, there are a couple of things. Northwestern, I should say at the outset, and I should also make it clear to people, too, that I'm, although if you ask, according to recent surveys, 6 out of 10 lawyers who've been practicing more than 10 years affirmatively counsel young people to stay away from law school. That's how unhappy the profession has become. But I'm one of the minority. In other words, I really had a great career. I had a very satisfying professional life, and I even enjoyed law school, which I think puts me in an even slimmer minority. The complaints that I had, really, as they relate to the profession generally, and Northwestern in some ways was an example. They have a new dean. I have to make that point clear as well. And much of what I criticize in the book, in fact, all of what I criticize in the book, was occurring under the former dean. But it's the same kind of pandering, really, to the methodology of the U.S. news ranking. So, for example, the former dean, back in 1996, when every other major accredited law school in the country was sending out notices to prospective law students that they should not allow the superficial appeal of a numerical ranking by U.S. News, which is filled with arbitrary decisions in terms of what counts and what doesn't, in some ways even perverse decisions, they shouldn't let those rankings distort their judgments. In other words, virtually all deans in the United States signed that letter cautioning students, warning them not to be taken in by the rankings, which at that point were almost 10 years old. Northwestern's former dean was the one significant dean in the country who dissented from that letter, refused to sign it, and argued that it was a source of potential information, and therefore it should be encouraged as a sort of a relevant piece of information for the market. And I just think that was just completely wrongheaded, because if the information that's going into the market is bad information, it's distorted information. You know, that's why there are legal doctrines such as fraud and deception and all that sort of stuff. And we can get into some of the details of how that has occurred over the years as law schools have pandered to the methodology of U.S. News, which is developed, by the way, by a non-lawyer editor. So, you know, the notion that these really are relevant to anything, if people really understood what went into the U.S. News rankings in terms of the methodology, I think they'd say, my gosh, and I have an undergraduate course where students say this every year as we spend a week on the rankings methodology, why would anyone even use this sort of approach to decide whether to buy a car, much less make a 3-year investment in a $150,000.
But it's important to U.S. News because, as you liken it to the swimsuit issue,
Well, it is. It's a critically important thing to U.S. News. You know, they rank everything, and going back to colleges and, I mean, just medical schools, hospitals. They rank just about everything. And sometimes their methodology is better than at other times. I have not done a survey of all the different methodological underpinnings of all their different ranking systems, but I can tell you that for law schools, it's counterproductive, and it distorts decisions, and it distorts decision makers when deans pander to the methodological criteria. We wind up with some very, very bad results, both for the schools and for the students in them, and for the profession at large.
Well, what should a prospective student use if not that?
Well, that's an interesting question. You know, I graduated from law school in 1979, and the rankings for law schools didn't even come out until 1987. And, gee, lo and behold, somehow for many, many years, students and schools were able to find each other. It's not that there isn't value in knowing certain things about law schools. So, for example, for years, for as long as I can remember, I think people generally agreed that the three schools at the top, in some order, depending on your preferences, would be Harvard and Yale and Stanford, and then you'd go down and there'd be another group, and so I don't object to the notion of having groupings that distinguish quality primarily based on selectivity and the quality of the faculty and the ability to place students in jobs. But when you have deans, you know, really doing, you know, all sorts of strange things to try to move themselves up two or three or ten spaces in the U.S. News rankings numbers, then it really gets upside down. So I encourage students who are thinking about law school in the class that I teach to just go beyond the rankings. In other words, just don't be... there were students who literally have said to me before taking my class, you know, if I get into school number 37 and school number 35, I'm going to go to school number 35 because it's got a better ranking. That is just a silly way to make a decision.
In fact, you talk about that... Some of the surveys sent to the law school deans included Princeton Law School, and some of the deans selected them on their list, and Princeton doesn't have a law school.
Right, and the same was true. There was another survey that somebody sent out trying to test the same proposition a number of years ago before Penn State was affiliated with any law school. Penn State didn't have a law school. The survey results that came back placed Penn State's law school in the middle of the pack, and it didn't exist. And the reason that's relevant is because 60%, 40% of the ranking that goes into U.S. News is something called quality assessment. And 25%, that is the biggest piece of that quality assessment, 25 out of the 40, is a survey that goes to four individuals at every law school in the country, 201 accredited law schools in the United States. It goes to the dean, it goes to the dean of academic affairs, it goes to the chair of the faculty appointments committee, and the most recently tenured faculty member. And those four people at every law school in the country are asked to rank from 1 to 5 the quality of every other law school's programs in the country. They have absolutely no basis for making that judgment. The response rate isn't bad, but we don't know how many of them are responding, don't know. And then there's another piece that's even more absurd, which is the 15%, again, we're talking about quality assessment, that goes out to practicing lawyers and judges. We don't know who it is. It's not a random survey. It doesn't even purport to be a scientific survey. And same kind of 1 to 5 ranking. People get these surveys and they say, okay, on 1 to 5, rank every single law school in the country. It's a ludicrous proposition. But the response rate last year, I think, for that portion, that is the lawyer, practicing lawyers and judges portion, was something like 9%. That's the biggest chunk of the ranking, is that kind of reputational. It's a branding exercise. It's not really a study in the quality of the institution.
So does it have any accurate information at all?
Oh, sure. It has little pieces of information. So it'll tell you, for example, what the range is of LSAT scores of the students they accept. It'll tell you how much it costs to go to school. It'll tell you what the GPA range is of the various for each school. But the difficulty is even that can create perverse outcomes. I'll give you an example. Lots of law schools have very aggressive programs whereby they actively solicit transfer students, that is, students who have already taken their first year somewhere else. Well, one reason they do that is because students who they may have rejected as entering first-year students can come into the school as transfer students, add revenues to the bottom line. Those students are not eligible for financial aid from the schools. And guess what? Their low LSAT scores don't count in the average for the school. So you wind up, you know, with that kind of, you know, stuff happening.
You know, one thing you said law schools are teaching to the test now, but that's rampant among most schools. I mean, even in elementary schools in Florida, they teach to this FCAT.
It's terrible. My wife is an educator of younger students mostly, but also she teaches in college as well. And, you know, the stuff that's happening is ludicrous. And that's why I say in some ways what the book is about is simply a slice of what's ailing the country. And I just think from time to time people need to stand up and say, wait a minute, what are we doing? My wife uses the example of test scores for young kids where they go through and they determine how many words the kid can read in a specific period of time. But they don't care at all whether the kid comprehends the meaning of the word. It's
right.
Irrelevant to the outcome. I mean, it's just silliness. And, but that's our, you know, we create the culture ourselves because we're constantly searching for so-called objective criteria, and then we don't really appreciate fully, I think, the subjectivity that goes into the so-called objective criteria.
We're speaking with Stephen J. Harper. He's a professor at Northwestern University's Law School, and he's an author. 30-year career as a litigator. The name of the book, The Lawyer Bubble, A Profession in Crisis. It's Topical Currents. We're going to take a short break, and we'll be right back.
And we're back on this Wednesday afternoon. It's Topical Currents. Joseph Cooper along with Bonnie Berman. If you'd like to join in our discussion with Stephen Harper, that's 1-800-743-9576, 1-800-743-WLRN. Also email, if you're a little shy, radio@WLRN.org. And also it's at Topical Currents for Twitter.
Right, if you want to tweet. So, Professor, the next problem, the debt that law students incur. But before we look at the debt, I'd like you to explain why law school tuition is increasing at such a high rate compared to other institutions of higher learning. Why is that?
Well, that's something that's a good question to pose to law school deans. It's, you know, tuition has doubled in the last 10 years and quadrupled in the last 25. And if you compare, for example, what's happened to medical schools or undergraduate tuition rates, they're nowhere near that rate of increase. I think there are a number of reasons that go to embedded costs and the cost of faculty and so forth. But one of the reasons has to do with the perverse incentives of U.S. News. You get one of the criteria for evaluation is expenditures per student. The more you spend, the higher your ranking. Mm. The problem is once a student pays his tuition, there's no check. In other words, there's no accountability for the dean and deans or the law schools in terms of whether the dollar spent creates value. And complicating all of this is the fact that students can relatively easily get gigantic loans to fund their tuition, and two things happen. One, they cannot discharge them in bankruptcy. They live with them for the rest of their lives, much like alimony, child support, and certain criminal fines and penalties. They're in a very unique select group of stuff you're stuck with until you pay it off or die. But the other thing that happens is the federal government stands behind all these loans, and the law schools, again, never have any accountability for graduates that, based on the most recent statistics, half of whom overall can't find jobs that long-term full-time jobs that require a legal degree. So there's a huge disconnect between the way law school is funded and the accountability for law schools for their results, and frankly, not much of a check in terms of having the price go up. The other reason price goes up, of course, is demand. You know, there are students that continue to want to go to law school. The number of applicants, even though everyone talks about how applications are down, which they are, still exceeds the number of available places. And as long as you have that situation, you know, deans looking at it will say, well, why can't I keep raising my price? The demand still exceeds the supply. And so that gets into a whole another level of analysis, which is, well, why is that? And then you're into some of the deception that has led students into law school, I think on just flatly false pretenses that there would be a good job waiting for them when they came out.
Stephen Harper, Let's move on a little bit to the big law firms and tell us about what you term the three-legged stool.
Yes, well, law firms, and by big law firms, I'm talking about firms that have that are the largest 250 firms in the country, and they have roughly between 10 and 15% of all the practicing lawyers in the country. So as a numerical group, they're a relatively small piece of the profession, but in terms of their influence, they're enormous because they do tend to set the trend. They do tend to be involved in the high-profile matters and the most sophisticated corporate problems and so forth. The three-legged stool is the way you get to the all-important metric of maximizing short-term profits, and it's billable hours, leverage ratios, which is the ratio of all attorneys to the number of equity owner partners in the firm, and hourly rates. And the way you maximize short-term profits is by increasing billable hours, that is requiring more billable hours out of the people who work there. And there have been all kinds of scandals. Most recently, a month ago, there was a front-page article in the New York Times about a big firm where there were internal emails about people essentially churning the file by doing unnecessary tasks.
Could you go back and help me understand that leverage business a little?
Yeah, the leverage piece. Yeah, that, fair question. The leverage piece has to do with, let's take a firm of, say, 100 lawyers. If 10 of them are equity partners, then the leverage ratio, which is the ratio of all attorneys, 100, to the 10 equity partners, is 10 to 1. Back 25 years ago, the leverage ratio for overall for the top 50 firms in the United States was about 1.7, so almost 2, between 1 and 2. So there were 1.7 lawyers in a firm for every equity partner owner who took profits out of the firm. Over the last 25 years, that ratio has doubled. So now it's another way to look at it is that it's become twice as hard to become an equity partner in a big firm as it was 25 years ago.
One of the things you said that kind of a couple of the things, one is the billable hour. Hasn't that been the goal for some time to increase the number of billable hours? And you also say law firms are focused on only the profits per partner each year, but hasn't that always been the case? I mean, have these things changed?
Yeah, I think they have, and I'll tell you why. And the change has been over time. But the big development came in 1985 when the American Lawyer began publishing, for everyone to see, data on the most profitable law firms in the country. They started with something called the Am Law 50.
What is that?
I'll tell you, it was called the Am Law, or the American Lawyer Am Law 50.
Okay.
They were the biggest and most profitable law firms in the country. Now we're up to the Am Law. The list has grown now, so now we're up to the Am Law 100, and now even the Am Law 200 is going to come out next month. And so that became a vehicle for a very competitive group of people, namely lawyers, to look around at their colleagues and say, "Well, there's a contest we ought to try to win. Let's go for it." And so you wind up in this sort of vicious circle of everybody's chasing each other's tails to higher and higher profits. But if you go back, for example, to the days when I was an associate in the early '80s, everybody worked hard. You know, being a lawyer has never been an easy job. And being a lawyer in a big firm, which is where I worked for 30 years, was never an easy job either. But no one ever focused on, you know, minimum billable hours per year as a criteria or a requirement for you to get your annual bonus at the end of the year. They just didn't exist. Now there are minimum billable hour requirements just about everywhere. And I should clarify, too, that, you know, in order to bill, let's say, 40 hours a week, honestly, a person really has to work 60, and you know, you're talking about losing evenings on a consistent basis. You're talking about not being able to have dinner with your wife and kids, or your spouse and kids, and or you're talking about, you know, losing a Saturday or maybe a Saturday and part of a Sunday. It has enormous implications for the lifestyle of the people working in the institutions.
Let's take a quick call. We've got Michael in Coral Gables. Hi there.
How are you doing? Good afternoon, everybody.
Hi.
I have never agreed with somebody more than I agree with Professor Harper. I am a lawyer. My entire family has a tradition of generations of lawyer. I myself went to John Marshall. My father went to DePaul. my daughter, who just became a lawyer recently, went to the University of Miami. When I was in law school, we were it was instilled in us to try to help society, to do good for the your common your fellow man. I'm sorry to, and that's the way I try to do things. I've been a prosecutor, I've been a judge, I am a diplomat, and I tried to, in addition to making money, try to help people. Unfortunately, the bottom line today is just that, the bottom line. Kids today are being worked to death in these large law firms. They are, as the professor said, working Saturdays, Sundays, nighttimes, holidays. And as a result of that, most lawyers I've spoken to have said, quite honestly, they would never recommend a kid go to law school anymore. I disagree with that. I love being a lawyer, and I love the profession. And there has to be something done about it. But it goes beyond the legal world. Just colleges today are a menace to get into, and people dwell on this, on these rankings. My son is a freshman at Dartmouth, and believe me when I tell you that the obsession with rankings and comparing each other's GPAs and SATs and LSATs is it's hopeless. And I feel sorry for these poor kids. They see, and I sit as a judge in, for high school and even junior high school practice courts and moot courts, and there still are a lot of lots. There's tons of kids who want to be lawyers, and I'm hoping it is not to try to hit a home run and make a score with money. We have to return to our basic values of what a lawyer is supposed to be, and a lawyer and this obsession with hitting the home run and making the quick buck and working these kids to death is just absolutely wrong.
Michael, let's let Stephen comment on what you've said.
I couldn't have said it better myself. And he identified an interesting dilemma, too, which is that there are, in fact, young people, lots of young people, who want to go into the legal profession, and they should go into the legal profession. Many of them should. But one of the reasons that becomes a problem later on is that many times the young people who head into the legal profession have a distorted image of what they think the life of a lawyer is going to be. You know, who wouldn't want to be Alicia Florek, you know, ending every episode of The Good Wife with a stunning cross-examination that wins the case for the client and becomes, my goodness, an equity partner after only 4 years for people who were paying attention to what's been going on. Well, that's just not the life that the vast, vast majority of lawyers lead. So it sets up a problem because one-third of the people who go to law school wind up making that decision while they're still in high school, and another third wind up doing it before they've completed their sophomore years. And then there's another group, probably the third group, that winds up sort of bumbling into law school as a kind of a the default solution. It's the last bastion of the liberal arts major who can't decide what to do next. And all of that creates two things. It's a combination of confirmation bias for those who have these preconceived notions of what it's going to be like and hopes about what it's going to be like. But then it also sets up, I think, a great deal of dissatisfaction among lawyers. You know, we lead races that nobody should ever want to win in terms of career dissatisfaction and substance abuse, alcoholism, that sort of thing. And that's because the reality becomes so much different from the expectations. So my hope, and the reason that I've frankly written the book, is as an outgrowth of the undergraduate course I teach, is that students will be willing to confront their own confirmation bias, take a hard look at the profession. I've tried to shine a light on some of the darkest and unspoken corners in order for people to see what they're like. And some people will continue to be gravitated towards those corners. You know, there are people who are always going to say, you know, if I can make $1 million a year, or I have a 10% chance of that brass ring, I'm going to go for it. And that's fine. I have no problem with people doing that. But I would hope that, and that's really the goal of the book, is that they would do it with a much more informed understanding of what they're getting into than the vast majority of people do that now.
We're speaking to attorney and professor Stephen J. Harper. He's at Northwestern University's Law School. And the name of his book is The Lawyer Bubble, A Profession in Crisis. Another short break, and we'll come back and take more calls. And stay with us. Mm-hmm. And welcome back to Wednesday's Topical Currents. Bonnie Berman here with Joseph Cooper. We're speaking with Stephen J. Harper, professor of law at Northwestern University and a 30-year career as a litigator. The name of his book is The Lawyer Bubble, A Profession in Crisis. Professor, I want to get back to something you just were talking about the substance abuse and all that. You cite lawyers as among the most clinically depressed professionals, in addition to having the greatest substance abuse record. I just want to know where that information comes from, and then to what do you attribute the problems other than what you just said? I mean, it has to be more than just expectation versus reality.
Yeah, let me take the last part first. Well, I mean, I can take the first part first. The surveys, there have been lots of surveys over the years of lawyers. The very first one that identified clinical depression came out in 1990 at Johns Hopkins. So in that sense, it's not a new problem. But there have been many, many surveys since that have identified the problems of lawyers and substance abuse. Usually there are various state bar associations that run the surveys, and then they very often wind up setting up crisis intervention programs, you know, trying to get lawyers to take advantage of them before bad things happen. Hmm. It is to some degree expectations versus reality. But I think another factor that sort of feeds into this is the way, particularly as it relates to big law firms, where the surveys demonstrate that lawyers are the most unhappy. So you have the paradox of wealth. The far more money is made in those places, and there are far more unhappy people than in places like government service, the public sector, the kinds of things that Michael has been doing that he found, the caller who found very rewarding. Lawyers still find very rewarding, but I think what's happened in larger firms is, number one, they've gotten much larger, and I think it's a real challenge to keep them from becoming impersonal places. And number two, there's a loss of autonomy. I think people feel that they're, you know, some small slice of a big problem without any real sense of the whole. And number three, there is the ongoing evolution has really put a premium on maximizing short-term profits. So that, for example, one thing that has happened is smaller cases where you could charge clients lower hourly rates in order to give good training and mentoring and opportunities to young people earlier are no longer cost effective. They're not as profitable as the bigger cases where you can put lots of people on them and bill $300 or $400 an hour, but the work is in general, particularly for the young people on those cases, not particularly fulfilling. Back in 1982, I was a third-year associate, and I had my first trial. But it never would have happened today because it was a small case, and it was a case that, because hourly rates were much lower, the client was able to afford to have our firm, namely me, do it. Mm-hmm. But it was a tremendously valuable opportunity for me. It was a fulfilling opportunity for me, and it was back into the world of a reality that was closer to my expectations. I grew up watching Perry Mason, and here I was in court actually trying a case after only a couple of years out of law school. So
I was a Matlock fan.
Yeah, well, there you go. I mean, in every generation you'll find somebody. You can go from Perry Mason to L.A. Law to Alicia Florek. It's a continuing, there's a continuing thread there for sure.
1-800-743-9576 if you'd like to join in. 1-800-743-WLRN. Also email, that's radio@wlrn.org. Next caller, Chuck in Miami.
Yes, I've been practicing law for 47 years, and I'm a former law school professor, and I'd really like to comment on two things that have been touched on. First, I think, is the unrealistic expectation of potential law students. When I was teaching law school, L.A. Law came on, and there was a one-third increase in law school applications at the time. And the studies, which may not have been scientific, attributed it to the unrealistic expectations of what it was like to be a lawyer. So I think that is one of the things that's creating a problem. And the other thing is, many large corporations who hire law firms now will not allow first and second year lawyers to work on a file. So that has, in a lot of firms, and mine is an Am Law 200, has shrunk the number of first and second year lawyers that we would like to hire, because if we have them work on a file, we do so at our own expense.
Yes, he's right on both counts. And the expectations reality theme, of course, is one that I've been talking about. And he's also correct on the second count, which is that clients are saying, well, he said it correctly as he finished his thought, which is, you can go ahead and put a first or second year person on the case, but they're not going to pay for it, or on the file or whatever you're going to work on, and that is a problem, and that's one reason that, for example, we graduated last year. I'm always amused when people think we're on our way to an equilibrium. You know, every year they're talking about, well, can everybody see how bad the market is? Why do kids keep going to law school?
Right.
Last year, we graduated a record number of lawyers, 46,000. Next year, the projection is that it'll be even higher. For the students who wound up getting jobs that required a degree, a JD degree, full-time, long-term meaning they were going to be working for a year or more, the percentage of the 46,000 who got full-time, long-term jobs requiring a JD was 56%. That's a long way from any equilibrium that I've ever considered as an economist.
What do the other 44% do? Did they perhaps go to law school to get into another profession, or?
Well, that wasn't the original intent, but that's what they wind up doing. So there are a few, although it's not a very large percentage, that wind up getting jobs that law schools. And this disclosure and transparency is a very new phenomenon. 2 years ago, you wouldn't have been able to even know this information. 2 years ago, if you asked what's the overall employment rate for all law schools throughout the country, the number that would have come back was 93 or 94%. That's because law schools were allowed, and the ABA allowed them to do this in the annual questionnaires, were allowed to count students, recent graduates as employed, provided they were working in some form or fashion on February 15th, which was 9 months after their graduation a year earlier. And you could count a person if they were a barista in a coffee shop, if they were a greeter at Walmart, if they were waiting tables, if they were babysitting, any job, anything counted. Now we know that some of those students, in fact, you could even count them if you hired them for a short time. That is, the law school itself hired them for a short time so they could be reported as employed for purposes of the U.S. News statistics. Now we know that some of them wind up, walking the streets looking for something to do. Some of them wind up taking part-time positions. Some of them wind up doing part-time contract attorney-type positions where you're essentially hired for a week or two. No benefits. It's a grim picture for a lot of people. It's not a grim picture for everybody. There are people who still are graduating from very good schools who are getting very good jobs and are going to be fine. But it's a grim picture for many more.
What accounts for the transparency in the last 2 years?
Well, I think it's agitation. I think it actually personally, I think it started with a New York Times article that David Siegel did back in January of 2011, where he started exposing some of the machinations that go into, for example, the reporting of employment statistics. And I think this has been a dirty little secret, for the law schools for a long time, and he exposed it to the light of day. And I think that, along with the fact that there are just increasingly increasing numbers of recent graduates who have, taken to the scam blogging having spent a lot of money, they're coming. 85% of law school graduates have average debt exceeding $100,000. Home mortgage, but no house. Well, that's going to create a lot of unhappiness out there, and over time, it's going to make its way through. And I think that the resulting heat that has landed on the American Bar Association to revise its questionnaire that it sends out to law schools every month.
In that mental health survey that you talked about, Stephen Harper, mm-hmm. it showed that. Public defenders are much happier than the big-time law firm employees. Of course,
right. They're
not bringing down the big bucks either.
Right. Yeah. That's sort of the irony in all this. I think that's a pretty easy one to understand. People who are public defenders or government work, or even in smaller firms, they're more likely doing the kinds of things that they expected they'd be doing when they finished reading Atticus Finch and To Kill a Mockingbird or watching L.A. Law or whatever it is they were doing. And I think that they're willing to sacrifice the financially in order to do it. And so, you know, it's an interesting conundrum because more and more now they're having this enormous albatross of a debt hanging over them. So,
you just mentioned the ABA. What role? How large is their role in all this?
Well, the ABA is the one that develops the questionnaire, for example, that law schools have to fill out every year as part of the ongoing accreditation process. And so, their role has been. And it's frankly been lax up until the last couple of years. They're getting better now, but their role has been to essentially allow law schools to get away with the nonsense that essentially says if you hire your own graduate for 3 months, you can count him as employed for purposes of your employment statistics, and then, by the way, just keep recruiting as many students as you can for purposes of those employment statistics. Meanwhile, law schools have grown. Generally, they've grown in enrollment. Recently, some law school deans are announcing that they're cutting back on enrollments, which is a terrifically good development. But we've opened a dozen new law schools in the last 10 years, and there are five more in the pipeline. Federal money is going to fund a lot of it. Student loan money is going to keep them going, and it's nuts.
We're speaking with Stephen J. Harper. He's professor at Northwestern University's Law School and an author. And the name of the book is The Lawyer Bubble, A Profession in Crisis. On today's Topical Currents, one more short break, and we'll be right back.
And we're back. It is today's Topical Currents. Joseph Cooper, Bonnie Berman, and attorney and professor Stephen Harper. Let's go to the phones. John, he's in West Palm Beach. Hi there.
Yes, good afternoon. I just wanted to have you comment on something that I feel has had the largest negative impact on the profession. I graduated in 74. Of course, back then it was much harder to get into school. It was much harder to get, seems to be much harder to get through the bar exam. And I think the biggest disservice that in Florida, I live in South Florida, is the advertising on billboards and phone books and buses. And, you know, it used to be that your profession was based upon referral, competent referral. And there weren't that many attorneys who were specializing in personal injury. Those that were did everything from medical malpractice to severe accidents and industrial problems, and now it seems like you can be 27 years old, get out of law school, if you got the capital to back you on the financing, you become a administrator of insurance claims, and they never go to court. They just settle out for the insurance benefits. I think it's really been a problem, and I don't see any decrease in it. It just seems to be getting larger and larger of a problem, in my opinion.
I agree with that. Unfortunately, we can thank the Supreme Court for that. There was a decision in 1975, I think it was, that basically opened up the legal profession to the advertising that we now see, and that frankly, every time I see on a bus or on a billboard, kind of makes me.
It's mostly personal injury and traffic.
Workers' compensation stuff. Yeah. It's bankruptcy. There's a guy that comes on regularly in Chicago that talks about bankruptcy. In the late night TV, it certainly demeans the profession, I think, but it's not going to go away.
Here we have a lot of immigration attorneys that do the same thing.
Yes,
and it almost makes you sick to your stomach. It really does. And these kids, they don't have any trial experience. They're not litigators. They just in mass follow these claims, and they don't really have the client's best interest at stake because they, as you know, they just take the insurance limits and take their 40% and build an office building and more billboards.
Yeah, I suppose the other aspect of that is if you actually didn't have a situation where you had so many more lawyers than you have actual legal jobs for them, you wouldn't wind up in these situations where, you know, essentially young people with very few alternatives say, well, I guess I'll just try to do what I can to, you know, get myself going this way. And then the next thing you know, they're advertising in the way that you suggest. So You know, it all becomes kind of part of the same circle of problem in a way, I suppose. But it's certainly demeaning, and it's certainly not the profession's proudest moment to turn on the TV or walk past a billboard and see that sort of thing.
Next up, sorry, Bob in Miami. Hi. Sorry about that. Bob, go ahead.
Yeah, hi. Thank you, Joseph, and I really appreciate your show. And I have a question for the professor, and that would be, you know, I've been a lawyer 35 years in Miami, and for me, going to law school was great for the education. And contrary to limiting and making it less popular for people to go to law school, I think in some respects we should have everyone in the population getting some degree of legal education, because we live in such a legal-based society that everyone needs something. Now, you know, we're basing our discussion on the fact that law school has become a vocational school, that, you know, people want to become lawyers and make money. But in some respects, I think perhaps we should have, like, two channels to law school, maybe one channel for 2 years or 1.5 years where people get educated in the law, and the second for those who have an affinity and the vocational ability to become great lawyers to actually finish and go to the full 3 years of law school. But to me, law school is the complete liberal arts degree that we who majored in liberal arts subjects really kind of need this extra legal-based training. I'd like that comments, and I'll take my comments off air.
Okay, thank you.
Professor?
Sure. Well, as with most things, the question is, at what price? So if you've got a law school that costs $45,000 a year in tuition, there's no question it's a valuable experience. I love law school. I think, by and large, there are lots of things in law school that train people to do a lot of important things, some of which involve the practice of law and some of which don't. The problem is, for those activities that don't require a JD degree, for example, I've heard people say to me, well, gee whiz, you know, law is a great background for business. Well, sure it is, but here's a suggestion. Why don't you save yourself $150,000 and just go directly to business school? So the question is, at what price does it make sense for people to incur debt? Because that's really what we're talking about here. 85% of the people who go to law school, as I mentioned before, are coming out with six-figure debt, and that number is growing at a distressing rate, and you're never going to get rid of it. So, as in all things, it's a balance, and the question is, you know, what makes sense? And at the end of the day, I think it probably comes down to each individual has to decide, and that's really the goal of my whole exercise in terms of the book is to think through carefully and thoughtfully what it is you think you're going to get out of a law school and or out of a law degree, and then make the jump. But think about it. Don't just do it.
Well, Professor, we're getting close to the end. We have a couple more minutes left. So amid all this depressing information and dysfunction,
you say
you're hopeful that the problems can be remedied. Let's talk about how.
Sure. Well, I think for law schools, it's pretty straightforward. You got to keep pummeling away at the confirmation bias of young people who are tracking themselves to law school but have no clear idea why. Other than TV shows. And, you know, confirmation bias, psychologists will tell you, is something we all labor with. We all want to believe the world is as we see it and not as we want to see it and not necessarily as it is, and we jettison data that's inconsistent with our beliefs. So you got to keep pummeling away at people before they enter that pipeline, not to discourage them, but to just make sure they're making an informed decision. I think the drive towards transparency will continue, and that's a healthy thing that will also help. And I think, finally, you've got to figure out a way to connect the financial implications for law schools that are taking advantage of students to what happens when these kids come out without jobs. And I think allowing them to discharge their debt in bankruptcy would be a helpful first step, and then allowing the federal government to go after those law schools when they had to back up those loans would be even better. In terms of law firms, you know, those aren't going to change in a dramatic fashion. The trends are going to continue for a while. But every once in a while, you're going to get a spectacular implosion of a big firm, and I document a number of them in my book, that reveals some of the ugliness that's hidden in these short-term trends and the emphasis on, you know, today's results at the expense of longer-term values. And ultimately, as people get a better look at what goes on in those places, I think there'll be opportunities for for a creative, what Joseph Schumpeter called creative destruction. There'll be new opportunities for people who want to think outside the box. And there's a generation coming up that views the world, I think, in a way that says, you know, you baby boomers, you didn't really get all this, all that great, and I can do better, and I think they're right. And
well,
they
Professor,
will.
We're just about out of time. It's really yes. been a pleasure speaking with you. By the way, we'll have a link at the Topical Currents Facebook page, which will take you to Stephen Harper's book, The Lawyer Bubble, A Profession in Crisis. Thank you very much, Professor.
Thank you very much. I enjoyed the conversation, and thanks to your listeners.
Thank you so much.
Thanks.
Topical Currents is produced by Richard Ives. Technical direction from Caroline Brader-Watts. Paul Leary is online producer. Free audio archives and downloads of this and past programs at our website, WLRN.org, and more information, including author and book websites, at the Topical Currents Facebook page. Tomorrow's program, we discuss the third largest barrier reef in the world, mostly in the Florida Keys. We'll discuss reef health and snorkeling and its rich history. Also, Linda Gassenheimer explores discount Miami Beach staycations. Also, wine columnist Fred Tasker will be on hand as usual. And now an all UK calendar for May 22nd. On this day in 1859, 154 years ago, the birth in Edinburgh of Sir Arthur Conan Doyle, creator of Sherlock Holmes, of course. A physician, he lived until 1930. And on this day in 1907, 106 years ago, the birth of actor and director Sir Laurence Olivier. He was knighted in 1947, buried in Westminster Abbey in 1989. His marriage to mentally tormented actress Vivian Leigh ended in 1960. One more before we burn down the mission. On this day in 1950, 63 years ago, the birth of lyricist Bernie Taupin, associated for many years, of course, with Elton John. Your Song, Country Comfort, Yellow Brick Road, Honky Cat, Rocket Man, Candle in the Wind. Our theme music created by Michael Levine. And we leave with a thought from Sir Arthur Conan Doyle, who created the genre of crime fiction. Quote, "Mediocrity knows nothing higher than itself, but talent instantly recognizes genius." Joseph Cooper, Bonnie Berman, thanks for listening. Up next, it's Talk of the Nation from NPR News.